Hello and welcome to the journalism.co.uk podcast, a show where we bring you insights from media industry experts to help journalists do their jobs better. I'm your host, Jacob Granger. Today, we'll be discussing the links between big tech and politics and how investigative journalists can uncover these connections. Non-profit news organisation, the Bureau of Investigative Journalism, has just published a major piece exploring how Russia is using facial recognition technology to identify dissidents. The year-long investigation looked into how unsuspecting online gig workers from the Global South were being used to improve this technology intended for undemocratic purposes. We're joined by the Bureau's big tech reporter, Niamh McIntyre, who explains how she used online communities like Reddit and YouTube to develop the investigation and build her story. We'll also discuss the big tech stories that are yet to be told, and you might be surprised that it isn't just about authoritarian regimes, but Western democracies too. Stay tuned. Niamh, welcome to the journalism.co.uk podcast. Thanks ever so much for coming on to our show.
Great. Hi, Jacob. Nice to be here.
Niamh, you've recently hit publish on an investigation, a brilliant investigation you've been working on, as I understand it, you know, for the last year or so, looking at how Russia is using facial recognition technology to identify, well, dissidents of Putin, whether that's supporters of the opposition or participants in protests or even quarantine violators dating back to the pandemic. The kicker, of course, as a tech story, is how this technology is being powered by unsuspecting online gig workers in the Global South. So a lot there going on. And I suppose maybe the place to start, I suppose, is how did this story really come across your desk? Where are the origins of this story from?
Yeah, sure. So I'm a tech reporter at the Bureau of Investigative Journalism. And since I joined, my focus has kind of been on tech stories that affect the Global South, with a particular focus on kind of the outsourced, menial, low-paid work that is really crucial in kind of powering the AI boom that we see today. So I spent a lot of my time speaking to people in places like India, Kenya, Colombia, who are doing things like content moderation or data labeling, kind of treating images and videos so they can be understood by AI systems. It was kind of within that broad context that we started looking into this particular platform called Toloka, through kind of speaking to gig workers doing this kind of work, but also just kind of hanging out in the online communities where gig workers gather, because obviously a lot of these people, they're just doing their work on their laptop remotely, and they often turn to places like Reddit and YouTube. So there's actually a lot of really interesting material in those kind of communities. And I started noticing that there were a lot of posts about this platform Toloka, which were kind of caught my eye because they involved things like sending in photos of your face or drawing boxes around human figures in images that seemed to be taken from CCTV cameras. So you could instantly see they were probably related to some kind of surveillance use case. And that was kind of our initial, oh, there's probably something interesting here. And then we kind of dug into it from that point on, really, by kind of gathering as much of that material as we could and then speaking to relevant sources.
Mega interesting. And, you know, just to take a step back, maybe for our audience who maybe hasn't read the piece yet, and of course I'd recommend that they do, they might be wondering, well, what has this platform called Toloka got to do with Russian surveillance? So maybe you can draw that line for us there.
Yeah, definitely. It is really a very kind of interesting, modern, weird phenomenon that gig workers who are in, you know, places like India, Bangladesh, Pakistan are doing these online tasks that are somehow connected to people in Moscow being detained for attending a protest. And the link is essentially that with any AI system, you need large amounts of data, and that data needs to be kind of organized and labeled in a way that the machine can learn and understand. Often that involves a lot of manual human labor. So for facial recognition, which is used to kind of compare faces that appear on a camera with a data set of, you know, wanted faces, that would often involve kind of tagging images of faces in some way, or uploading images of faces, because you need lots of images for datasets to learn.
Their own faces as well is the important part. It's their own faces.
Yes, which is makes it feel a little more kind of creepy and invasive in that way. And so the two companies that we ended up looking at, Entech Lab and Tevian, they are major suppliers of facial recognition software to the Russian government. It's used in a number of Russian cities, but particularly in Moscow, it's most extensive, and the facial recognition systems there are hooked up to street cameras, and it's a very extensive public surveillance system, which has led to the kind of detention of hundreds of people over the past few years.
Yeah, and what you said there is important, because that's where a lot of the contentiousness about this story comes from, right? Because some of those companies are based in EU countries like the Netherlands, which are not allowed to deal with what is a sanctioned state in Russia.
This was one of the more complicated aspects of the stories. Entech Lab and Tevian, who are the two Russian surveillance companies that were using TeLoCA to train their systems, they have been sanctioned by the EU on the grounds that their software was being used in this way to kind of politically arrest and detain people. Under EU law, if you're an EU company, you shouldn't be making payments or receiving payments from a sanctioned company. But it got very complicated due to the kind of corporate structures involved. And when we went to TeLoCA, they said that actually the payments had kind of gone through a Russian subsidiary. And so the money had never really left Russia in that respect, was their view. So in their view, that was not a breach.
I think the one thing you realize when you read a story like this is that it's, how do I put this, deliberately complex. Like, it's designed to be hard to untangle for journalists. So I would kind of put that back to you and say, well, how did you and the team get into the weeds of this, make sense of it, untangle it, and try and see what the story was?
Yeah, no, I think that's a really good question, because we definitely had a lot of conversations around that point, because there are a lot of different angles. Initially, you know, we had a version that kind of more emphasized the gig workers being unknowingly recruited to do this kind of work aspect, and then we emphasized the sanctions aspect, and then we kind of went back to actually maybe we should be emphasizing the fact that there are real people in Moscow whose lives have been completely changed because of this technology. And then we ended up kind of leading with that in the end. But it was definitely a challenge, because there are some aspects of the story that were, yeah, quite technical, not just the sanctions, but also, you know, you have to explain what a gig work platform is, why companies like Tevian and Entech Lab would use it. And I think one thing that I think really helped bring that to life and kind of make it a little bit less dry was those human stories from the brave people in who'd since left Russia that we spoke to, but also our production team made some cool like looping GIFs of the work actually being done on the platform, so you can kind of the because it was quite a visual story, I think that really helped. And we also made a nice video for social showing like what it actually looks like to do these tasks, that I think help bring it to life a bit.
I think that's significant because this story does have different levers that you can pull on to find kind of a news hook. And between, you know, the video explaining you touched on there, you've got a piece that's like how we found the story. You've got the main investigation itself. You've got the piece that you led within the newsletter. You've got different ways of leading with a certain angle, which is one of the things I definitely noticed.
Yes.
Can you expand on that at all in terms of what was the decision making and how did you kind of fit the angle to the medium in which that you were using?
Yeah, definitely. So we're trying to do more that we're calling like involve pieces. So trying to involve the reader and show them how we did the story, because I think that's something that people are often quite interested in.
Showing your working, basically, right?
Yeah, showing our working. So it's about being transparent and skill sharing, but also, yeah, trying to kind of involve the reader in a different...
But Jesper also did that sort of vertical video style explainer with the mic and the little green screen behind him in a very sort of TikTok-ish kind of way. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and we are, videos, the other thing that we're trying to do a lot more of at the moment. Our audience team just posted today saying that it done really well on TikTok.
I like that because it brings the investigative journalism kind of to life. Do you know what I mean? Where it can often be quite lengthy and dry, it kind of brings it home a little bit, doesn't it?
Yeah, exactly. That's what we were
aiming for. Good stuff. Just a quick one from me and then we'll get back to the show. Join us on the 22nd of May at our next Digital Journalism Conference News Rewired in London. We've got plenty of talks lined up on generative AI, newsletters, young audiences, and much, much more. I'll be there, and I'd love to see you there too. Head over to newswire.com for the full agenda and to grab your place today. Quoting you here in the story, Toloka is a little-known tech platform, but you were saying before you kind of found out about that through Reddit, right? That was kind of the big thrust initially with the story.
Reddit and kind of YouTube.
Reddit and YouTube.
Yeah, like, you know, using... open source information, really. And then we started building up, kind of documenting various examples of these tasks that were being done for TV in an NTech lab, just by kind of screen recording them and putting them into a spreadsheet. And what was really helpful, actually, compared to other gig work platforms, was that you could see which company had requested the task.
Right.
So we instantly had a link, whereas that's quite unusual. Most other gig work platforms wouldn't display who'd requested it, and there's a lot more secrecy there. So that was definitely really useful.
But that gave you something to chase then, really.
Yeah, exactly.
So what did you do then from there?
So then, like I said, kind of we built up this kind of database of many examples of the tasks being done for TV in an NTech lab. And I think we ended up with sort of somewhere around 20. And then we started reaching out to sources. So people who had actually done these tasks, and kind of just asked them a bit more about what it had involved, if they were aware that it might have, you know, fed into these facial recognition systems, how they would feel about that, etc. And then we kind of realized that it would be great to have examples of people who had, on the other end of the system in Moscow, who'd been kind of harmed by the surveillance. So we started reaching out to those kind of case studies, and we got some really powerful ones, particularly Alexei, who was a former local politician who basically got told that his image had been captured on camera, and that he was charged with something, and then he fled kind of Moscow 2 weeks later and has never been back.
Was it hard to get him on the record publicly about that?
I think he feels very strongly about his experience, and he already had a, you know, something of a public profile anyway, being a local politician. So he was actually very happy and motivated to go on the record.
Probably unlike the others, I would have thought. I mean, appreciating completely the sensitivities about sources right now, but I would have thought it'd been quite hard to get other people to speak about this.
Well, I think we took kind of a decision that we would only speak to people who'd had experience of being caught up in this system, but who had since left Russia, because we just felt it would be too risky to try and speak to anyone currently in Russia.
So how did you get hold of the gig workers themselves then? Did you use the platform itself, or did you kind of have to find roundabout ways of getting in touch with them?
No, we did. Yeah, we did briefly consider that, but I think we just decided it was more straightforward to just go through the kind of online communities where they were gathering, so in like YouTube and Reddit, and to a lesser extent Facebook.
There's another important player in this investigation, and that's Yandex, Russia's biggest tech platform, often called Russian Google. Yandex has an HQ in Amsterdam and is listed on both New York's Nasdaq exchange and the Moscow Stock Exchange. Until recently, it was closely linked with Western financial institutions and had a lot of Western investment. After Russia invaded Ukraine, Yandex had been strong-armed to sell up on unfavourable terms, and it is now entirely under Russian ownership. As Vladimir Putin's presidency has progressed, Yandex's ties with the Kremlin have grown stronger. For example, under pressure to comply with the Kremlin's demands over content, Yandex sold its news aggregator and other online resources to state-controlled rival VK in late 2022, hoping to depoliticize its business. This illustrates the increasingly narrow gap between big tech and authoritarian regimes, making it a crucial area for investigative journalists and news organizations to monitor.
A term a lot of people are using is the balkanization of the internet, or the splinter net. So you're going to have this Russian internet and like a Chinese internet and a kind of Western internet. And I think companies like Yandex, and the fact that it's had to pull back from, you know, the international aspects of its business, certainly do fit into that theme.
What sort of challenges does that present for you as a big tech reporter then?
The way we found this story was very much through an open internet where workers from all over the world were just posting. Hypothetically, you know, it could have been that gig workers in a certain part of the world wouldn't have been able to post on these global interconnected kind of forums. When I was trying to research Russian government contracts, had to pay for a specific Russian VPN to have a look at those, because they don't want people from outside Russia looking at them.
And a good translation tool, I would have thought.
Yes. yeah, exactly. It's definitely an interesting time, and I think it's not quite clear how it's gonna play out at the moment.
No. But I mean, sticking with the idea of, you know, you being the big tech reporter at the Bureau, what else is really changing and moving in this space and causing you to maybe rethink the way that you're approaching or investigating stories?
Yeah, well, I think the other theme of the story is these connections between big tech companies and authoritarian governments and also kind of the defense industry. So that is something that I'm thinking a lot about at the moment. I'm also doing this fellowship with the Pulitzer Center, which is kind of focusing on those links, on kind of digital authoritarianism and the links between tech companies and the defense industry. So obviously this story was looking at that,
right?
Those links in Russia, but I'm going to be kind of pursuing similar themes in other parts of the world. Trying to look at other government contracts in languages I don't understand. It's something that you're seeing a lot at the moment in the US and also in Gaza. There's been a lot of really good reporting recently about the role of AI in the kind of bombardment of Gaza, which I think is a trend that we're kind of going to unfortunately see more and more.
Interesting you bring up the US. You think this will start being a theme within democracies then, Western democracies?
Yeah, well, I think comparing it to this current story, obviously facial recognition is used pretty widely in in the US, you know, not as undemocratically as it is in Russia, but there's been a lot of kind of questioning the legitimacy of certain uses of it in the US. The links between US AI companies and the US defense industry, I think, is becoming increasingly prevalent as the kind of defense sector really instrumentalizes AI. They are turning to tech companies increasingly to help them fulfill those needs.
Great. So lots of stories left to be told then.
Yes, hopefully.
Okay, a final thought for you then is one thing obviously I do notice is your name is not the only byline on the investigation. You had lots of colleagues obviously pitching in as well. What is the role of the wider team in terms of helping an investigation like this take form?
So the people who had the joint bylines on the story were actually colleagues from other publications, from Paper Trail Media and Follow the Money, who are two kind of European investigative outlets that kind of function in quite a similar way to us. So they were really great to work with, particularly because they had some kind of contacts and connections that we didn't have within, you know, Brussels, and as far as kind of understanding the finer points of EU sanctions goes. But within TBIJ, obviously, my editor wrote the kind of Involve piece and fronted the video. We have a very stringent fact-checking process. So somebody kind of has to go through every fact in the story and kind of tick it off when it's okayed. So that was my colleague, Joe, did a lot of that work. And then, yeah, we talked a lot about, you know, bringing the story to life with the kind of visual material. So that's the audience and production team have a big role there.
And I'm sure you need your colleagues as well. I mean, I'm right in saying the investigation took a year to take form, right?
Yes.
How does it feel now to see the story out after working on it for such a long time?
I'm really, 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 really pleased. There was definitely some lows in the process. So it's always nice for it to be out in the world. I think it's really cool that it was published in so many different languages, because we went with kind of Le Monde, ZDF and Spiegel in Germany. You know, we had Delphi in Estonia, Expressen in Sweden. So I think it's the most languages a story of mine's ever been kind of published in. So that was really nice. And we've had, I think we've had a good response so far. We're kind of following some news we've had from the Dutch House of Representatives, where a Dutch politician there is kind of asking the Foreign Affairs Minister to look into the claims, the ones which relate to kind of the Dutch company. And we may be publishing a follow-up story tying up the various bits of impact that we've had, hopefully in the next week or two.
Well, looking forward to that. All the best with it, and looking forward to the next investigation too. Niamh, thanks so much for coming on our show. It's been a blast. Thanks.
Okay, great. Thank you so much.
My takeaway for today is to look for the breadcrumbs in online communities. The origins of this major piece are in Reddit and YouTube, where people were sharing tips on how to complete tasks for the company to Locker. The way AI is taking shape now is bound to leave more of these crumbs lying around. Niamh's investigation is a great example of journalistic skill, collaboration with different media partners, and the power of online communities. All of those classic skills are still as important as ever. But as the internet becomes the splinternet, it will be harder and harder for journalists to gain access to sources, particularly inside authoritarian regimes. A thought for the future, and one we will explore another time. But if you have any thoughts on this, I'd love to hear them. Find me on LinkedIn, Twitter @x@jpgjournalism, or email me on jacob@journalism.co.uk. You can check out all of our episodes on all your usual podcast platforms like Spotify and Apple Podcasts. Just search and subscribe to the journalism.co.uk podcast. But that's all we have time for this week. I've been your host, Jacob Granger. Thanks so much for listening. Till next time.